difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Keith Phipps,
Genevieve Kosky,
and Tasha Robinson.
On the first half of this episode, we discussed Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible, which launched the biggest franchise of the biggest movie star in Hollywood. With this half, we'll look at Mission Impossible Fallout, in which De Palma is long gone, but Tom Cruise remains, 22 years later, shattering bones and risking his life for our edification. With Fallout, the Mission Impossible franchise has, for the first time, used the same director twice. That director is Christopher McQuarrie, who made his name in Hollywood for writing the screenplay for The Usual Suspects, wrote the script for the Tom Cruise film Valkyrie, and has now directed four films for Cruise, two Jack Reachers and two Mission Impossibles. And with a continuity in direction, Fallout is also the first Mission Impossible to have a pretty decent amount of continuity in the plotting, too. The villain from the last film, Rogue Nation, his name is Solomon Lane, he's back, though now that Lane has been captured, his terrorist organization, once known as the Syndicate, has now been reformed into the Apostles. Rebecca Ferguson has also returned as Ilsa Faust, a former MI6 agent who helped Ethan Hunt and his IMF team in the last film, but is walking a bit of an intelligence tightrope in this one. The plot is, of course, the usual nonsense. As the film opens, Ethan tries to secure three plutonium cores from the Apostles, but loses them after choosing to save a team member's life rather than the potential lives of millions. Though lacking in official support as usual, Ethan is eager to seek redemption by getting the plutonium cores back. But he first has to get through a viper's nest of adversaries, including Vanessa Kirby as an arms dealer known as the White Widow, Henry Cavill as a CIA operative sent to shadow him, and a mysterious figure named John Lark, who appears to be the guy behind the guy behind the guy. Whatever the case, it's all a pretense to 150 minutes of spectacular action sequences and stunts, including a motorcycle chase through Paris and a helicopter chase through Kashmir, with nothing less than nuclear annihilation at stake.
You had a terrible choice to make in Berlin. One life over millions. And now the world is at risk.
This is the CIA's mission. If he had held on to the plutonium, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Down with the victims. We both know you need them. Stuck in the middle. All irrelevant.
You don't understand what you're involved in.
You need to walk away.
How many times has Hunt's government betrayed him, disavowed him, cast him aside? How long before a man like that has had enough?
Ethan, that's not who we are.
Maybe we need to reconsider that.
So, how is he?
Oh, you know, same old Ethan.
So, I think we talked a little bit in the last episode about how the Mission Impossible movies are all trying to sort of top each other, so, and this is probably the biggest of the Mission Impossible movies. Is it the best, or is it one of the best?
No.
Before we go any farther, I have been suspecting this entire recording that Tasha did not enjoy Mission Impossible Fallout, so I want to start with Tasha.
I didn't love it, guys. I mean, okay, so here's the thing. There's a couple things going on here. One, I think the back-to-back of Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation were just a couple of really terrific, involving action sequences. And Rogue Nation, I think, really proves the point for me that Scott was making about how these films are about sequences, because there's so many sequences in it that I just found really memorable. I went into this with a fully open mind, like not expecting too much, in spite of the people that were saying it's the second coming of Mad Max Fury Road. I was just kind of open to a bunch of stuff happening in an exciting kind of way. And the first hour of the film, roughly, I just kind of felt like, and it's another car chase, turning into a motorcycle chase, turning into a foot chase, turning into a car chase, turning into a motorcycle chase.
Oh, yeah, one of those.
But it's just one of those nonstop action thrill rides. It just didn't stand out to me at all. I don't know. I found myself mentally wandering to like movies as disparate as like The French Connection and The Italian Job, just in terms of how many car chases I've seen over the years. And it really, it's ironic given everything that I just said about 1996 Mission Impossible. But here, I don't feel like I started to get engaged until like human stakes started being a thing, which I just don't think they were at first. So you guys were in it from the get-go. You were completely taken and mesmerized by this film.
I mean, I like this movie a lot, but to go back to Scott's question of whether it's the best Mission Impossible movie, I don't think it is. And I actually agree with you, Tasha, that I think kind of the back-to-back of Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation is the height of the series. I still like this movie a lot. I've actually seen it twice already, and I was fully engaged both times. But to go back to the idea of sequences, these are probably not my favorite sequences in the franchise. There's a lot about them I like, and I actually think that bathroom fight is really impressive as a piece of fight choreography, and which is something that like I don't feel that we've gotten a whole lot of from this series. And like it's not a series I really think of in terms of hand-to-hand combat, and kind of going back to the idea of staging a sequence and like showing you where you are physically in the space, like it was very good at that.
It's fight choreography, and it's fight choreography as storytelling too. Mm-hmm. There's narrative to a progression and a narrative to what happens in that room that's its own kind of little story, you know, story unto itself.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, almost a recalling back to that first film. It's a clean white space where you can see everything,
mm-hmm. yeah,
and where the camera takes the time to explore it first. Yeah, that was the moment that hooked me in, but that was also the moment where I actually started feeling the stakes. And I will say, I was taken very slightly out of it, as cool as it is, by the fact that I've already seen Henry Cavill have an amazing back-breaking, like, one-on-one fight with somebody in a bathroom in Man from U.N.C.L.E., mm-hmm. which is a movie I feel like this hit a bunch of the same beats as that, and it did it earlier and in some ways better.
And kind of with the idea of hitting the same beats, to speak to another sequence in this film, like the chase sequence in Paris, really good chase sequence, but we've seen Ethan Hunt do a bunch of stuff on a motorcycle before, you know, and it felt like, what is distinguishing this Ethan Hunt on a motorcycle sequence from the other two or three that I've seen in the series? And again, really liked it, enjoyed it in the moment. It was extremely well executed, but it wasn't wow the way like him hanging off the Burj Khalifa was. That's something I never would have even thought of. And it's like riding a motorcycle around Paris, like, yeah, that's something I would expect Ethan Hunt to do. So, and even the helicopter chase showdown, you know, like we had a helicopter showdown in the very first the movie we just talked about, you know, it was a very different kind mm-hmm. of helicopter showdown. But kind of the big standout sequences in this movie, like they were all bigger and more extreme, but they weren't necessarily unexpected, which I think maybe took the thrill down just a little bit from something like Rogue Nation and that like underwater turbine sequence, you know, mm-hmm. which is just felt so inventive. Nothing here felt quite as inventive as what I think of as the series at its height.
Well, there are a finite number of vehicles.
Right. Exactly. I want the big blimp showdown.
Yeah. I'm
we've already gotten that in a Bond movie. Which Bond movie was that? Where the with Malcolm McDowell and a blimp sneaks up on the heroine.
Oh, View from Raquel. Yeah, okay. That's not
the most well liked James Bond movie.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, and kind of with you in that it's the first one where I feel like you can kind of feel the effort to top previous efforts mm-hmm. in some ways. Ghost Protocol is my favorite, but pretty healthy margin is my favorite of the films. I just feel like the action scenes in that are so lyrical, the staging, the plot is smooth. Yeah, I love that one, and it's I think it's my favorite action film of the century. But this is like number two for me, I think. Yeah, it's really, I mean, just it's a thrilling couple of hours. Well, you know, Scott and I were talking about it. Like, it is two amazing hours of action scenes, and like, oh, you know what? You've been good. Here's another half hour. That's probably better than anything that's come before it, too.
Yeah, I think you're ready to say, all right, I think I've seen a satisfying film, I'm ready to go home, and then it hits you with the grand finale. I really like this film a great deal, and maybe the conceits for the action sequences are more expected, but they're bigger and they're mm-hmm. exceptionally well executed and very, very exciting. It just hooked me from the beginning because of the business with
the wolf blitzer
bit is so good. And the thing I really enjoyed about it was like, I was initially fooled that this actually had happened, And then I thought, oh, wait, you know, this is like, what a bummer way to start, like, you know, to start the movie. And I thought, then it, I finally kind of figured out in advance of the twist, what the twist was. And I just like, I just started to get really excited because I knew when it was going to get pulled that the audience was going to really be delighted by it. And the reveal is so entertaining and witty. And I really was on board for this film from the beginning. But I mean, maybe it is, you know, I mean, there are elements that can't be as exciting as they were before. I mean, I think of a character like Ilse Faust, who's just a wonderful character and had such a strong introduction and presence in the last film. It's like, can't reproduce that. She's already been introduced. I think she has a really cool role in this film too. I'm glad she's part of the team. And I think the team dynamics in this movie are very crisp and satisfying.
Yeah, it's Peg and Rames as backup.
And as a fan of this series, like, even as I am noticing, you know, certain tropes becoming like very, very well trod, like there is a certain pleasure in seeing those tropes and like how they are played this time. And I'm thinking specifically of how hard I laughed at the second time that Ethan Hunt was given just a huge wide open space to run at full bore down, you know. Yeah. And then like Ethan Hunt running is Tom Cruise running is a thing, but just like the way that this movie played into it, it made me laugh, and that was its own form of entertainment beyond like how effective the scene was as action. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah. I enjoyed the running sequence because it lampoons itself. Yeah. For me, that car/boat/motorcycle chase, I just found the choreography really repetitive. I mean, they pull that thing where somebody drives full bore through an intersection with cars headed in both directions like four times, I want to say. And there's so much of it, but the stakes have already been kind of blown early on in that chase. Like the whole thing is kind of a shell game where they're trying to hide the pee, where the pee is Solomon Lane. And the second they've got him bagged and in the boat, that chase sequence is done. And then it goes on for what feels like another 20 minutes where the only stakes are Ethan Hunt is trying to shake his pursuers. And then they pick him back up again, and then the chase starts again. And for me, it's just like, if you're going to have that much action sequence, you have to have that action sequence be about something. And too much of it was just about, can I get away from the people that somehow are still tailing me, despite the fact that I've been getting away from them for 10 minutes?
I see. The thing is, I can't take any of that stuff for granted because it's so rare. Because just the idea of physical action and practical effects, you just don't see it. I mean, and so this, for me, watching these movies, particularly the recent ones, which have been so blown out, it's just thrillingly different and against the grain from what other blockbuster franchises are doing. I find myself so much more excited by watching what might be a standard action sequence on steroids being done in the context of 2018 and the way movies are being made now. It's satisfying because nobody else is doing this. And this is kind of like the way I want things done. If I had my druthers, I'd want more practical effects, more stunt work. And you get a little bit of that in your John Wicks and stuff too.
Yeah, it's almost become a subgenre, like action film with actual action in it.
Yeah, and I'm on board with that. Atomic Wicks, Blonde, the whole Atomic thing. Blonde, I'm on, like, that stuff
Haywire.
To me is,
yeah,
Haywire is great. I mean, if that's the goal, to put together well-constructed action sequences with stunt work and practical effects, I'm almost always up for that.
But here's the thing. Every one of these films that we're citing, they're fundamentally built on physical, you know, one-on-one, maybe two-on-one, like close action combat. And all of them built around like just bone-breakingly horrifying physical fight choreography that kind of takes your breath away because you can feel the impact of it. And I feel the impact, like that bathroom sequence is my favorite sequence in the film. The scene in the diner between Gina Carano and Channing Tatum is like my favorite sequence in Haywire. Mm. In John Wick, it's, I don't know, every single one of them because they're all kind of samey, but it's about the choreography, and I feel it so much more keenly when people are facing off like that than I do when a car is, you know, driving through a whole bunch of other cars. That Ilsa sequence that you cite, like, there are so many huge action sequences in these films, but Ilsa's introduction is hands down my favorite Mission Impossible sequence for the entire series.
In the interrogation sequence
where he pulls himself physically off that pole. I don't even know. It's like a reverse salmon ladder. I don't know what the hell you call that. And the jail escape sequence from Ghost Protocol. Like, so much of that stuff is about the movement of human bodies. And it's just, that always fascinates me so much more than the movement of vehicles.
Well, you know, in to support your point a little bit more,
I love how many of these podcasts start with, I can't believe that's your opinion. What's wrong with you? And then end up with like 5 minutes of, well, okay, here's about why you're right.
Well, I'm just saying, to support your point about how exciting these sort of close quarters action scenes are, think about like the two close quarters action scenes in Kill Bill, the first one with Fox, and then the one I'm really the bit with Daryl Hannah in the trailer, and just, you know, that space dictates the action, and there's so many kind of creative uses that have to be made of available tools and objects. I mean, and that was always Jackie Chan's thing too. It's like Jackie Chan, you know, it wasn't this formalized thing where he was going to take on one person at a time in a large space. He was going to get attacked by all quarters in, you know, say a bar, and then have to use, you know, table legs and stuff to defend himself. Those are exciting. Credit the film for kind of mixing it up a little bit, giving you a little bit taste of that, a little taste of him hanging out from helicopters at all.
Well, and the sequence that leads up to that bathroom sequence, which is like similar, but also like the complete opposite, which is the skydiving, them parachuting into Paris. Oh, yeah. And that whole thing with
Paris shooting.
Yes. Paris shooting into the party. But I was sitting here listening to you talk about these like kind of intense, like two-person one-on-one sequences. And like, that is also kind of like that sequence. Like, it's just Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill, but they're just like floating in space, you know, and there isn't anything around them. So like, there is this other type of choreography happening here, but like, that sequence, I didn't find that exciting. Maybe it was, and I know it was like, it's very exciting that Tom Cruise jumped out of a plane. Good for you, Tom Cruise. But like, just watching it, maybe it was because it was so dark. Maybe it was just like the fact that they were so far away from each other.
Chicago's IMAX has terrible light bleed.
That could have been it too.
Maybe because at that moment you're like, why don't you just let him drop? He's a jerk.
Yeah.
Well, it tells a story, like the bathroom scene.
It does tell a story. Although again, that exact same dynamic happens in Man from U.N.C.L.E. So I was kind of a little out of that one.
Man from U.N.C.L.E. advocacy. I can't.
It's weird, but that movie has really stuck with me because of the really good character work it does.
I haven't seen it. I know it's got a growing rep as a good movie a lot of people missed, so I should check it out.
I tried watching it and fell asleep, but because I had heard good things from you and other people. But I should probably go back and give it another chance, because I really liked Henry Cavill here a lot. And if it's, you're saying that it is, you know, of a piece with what I should expect from Man from U.N.C.L.E., I think I will
and
probably
Army's
give it
in that
chance.
One too.
Yep, it's him and Armie Hammer in just the most brotastic. First they hate each other, then they love each other. Game ants of all time. It's
maybe that should be your
thing.
Maybe that should be your next picture show.
Yeah, Cavill is just sort of a big jerk in this movie. It's really effective. Like, here's this guy. He's a big jerk, and you find out he's an even bigger jerk than you thought he was. But I mean, like, it's
he's a brute.
He's a brute. Yeah, he's a blunt instrument. He pulls that off very well. And the mustache is amazing.
Yes.
And you just keep seeing him as Superman, possibly with that mustache CGI'd off.
I never saw. I heard it was distractingly false looking. Right.
I didn't, you know, other people say it didn't really read for me, but
the effects are amazing.
I sometimes miss some stuff like that. So.
To be honest, I didn't notice because there's so much else artificial in that movie and so many other problems. Like,
we are talking about Justice League, by the way.
You know, overall speaking, I enjoyed Justice League. It has like a lot of good points, but it's got enough problems that I was not busy staring at Henry Cavill's upper lip the entire time.
So many reservations about Mission Impossible Fallout. Now we get a semi-endorsement of Justice League. I don't know if we can handle it.
This is Tasha's most controversial episode ever.
It is.
I'm basically am worse than Hitler.
We'll continue to address that particular point.
My worseness than Hitler?
Yeah, that's part of the
connection. That's the first connection.
That's our first connection.
Things that are worse than Hitler. John Lark or Tasha.
But we will be right back after the break to talk about the connections between Mission Impossible and Mission Impossible Fallout.
Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
What do you think you're doing, Erica?
It may be your mission, but this is the CIA's plane. It doesn't take off without my say-so.
We need reliable intelligence, and we need it now. This scenario is precisely why the IMF exists.
The IMF is Halloween, Alan. A bunch of grown men in rubber masks playing trick-or-treat. And if he had held on to the plutonium in Berlin, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
And his team would be dead.
Yes, they would. That's the job. And that's why I want one of my own men on the scene to appraise the situation. Agent Walker, Special Activities.
His reputation precedes.
You use a scalpel. I prefer a hammer. My man goes, or no one goes.
Now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. And boy, do they have a lot of things in common, don't they? Starting with the title, Mission Impossible.
Oh my God, I didn't see that parallel. Yeah.
You know what they don't have in common? Punctuation. I guess they do both have a colon.
It's Mission, colon, Impossible.
You're right.
It's an N dash and not an M dash, is that right?
M dash is the longer one.
Yeah.
So I think it's so an
it's
M
like,
dash.
But it's not just a dash. It's like between the two, right?
I don't know. I didn't break out the ruler when I passed the movie poster.
This conversation
you've been editing copy on this film, haven't you?
Yes, we have used the M dash, and what you have here is an M dash. So.
Oh boy.
Oh my God! It's so much repetition. You guys have just driven this conversation through an intersection with cars going both directions like four times in a row. Yeah. And I'm so disengaged.
I wrote something for the post on the Mission Impossible movies, and I was copy pasting the title for Mission Impossible Fallout to make sure that everything was square.
It's option shift hyphen.
Option shift hyphen. Okay.
Don't say we didn't teach you things, kids at home. We are the most useful podcast.
Rather than shift command dash.
Your mission, if you choose to accept it, is to put the right length of dash in the title for Mission Impossible.
Keep in mind, I just want everyone to know that when we were all working together at the Dissolve, it's this kind of business that we'd be talking about the most. It's this kind of like super granular stuff that really was the difference maker.
It's what put us out of business.
The reason they laid us all off was because we couldn't decide on the M dash versus N dash thing in a film title.
And they didn't like our bi-weekly meetings on the subject for some reason.
So now it's time for Connections. When we bring these two films.
So wait, what connects Mission Impossible and Fallout? Is it an N dash or an M dash?
Well, we look forward to your emails and voicemails on that topic. But let's talk about Tom Cruise, because Tom Cruise has aged somewhat from he's aged 22 years from.
But has he?
He has. He looks like such a baby face in the first movie.
He really does.
Yeah, it's more that he looks really young in that one than he looks old in this one.
True.
Yeah,
he looks younger than 56 in this. But I will say, I'll make a couple of points about him in this. One is that I think there's a really great, funny moment in the bathroom sequence where it is gone on for such a long time that he looks just tired and not wanting to go on. And there's this kind of like mini moment of vulnerability that I really liked. And that is repeated throughout the film.
Yeah, there's definitely a few moments of people getting one over on Ethan Hunt physically in this movie.
Yeah, so I like that. I mean, a little bit of rare humbling of Tom Cruise.
I actually don't think it's rare at all. I think this kind of to speak to your earlier point about what makes a Tom Cruise movie. I think more and more I'm seeing this in films that have him in action, like him having those moments of having been physically bested. And I don't know if that's touching on the way that he's aging, or maybe his ego is relaxing a little bit to the point where like he can allow himself to get the crap kicked out of him. But I mean, as I say, there's a lot of suffering in these movies. And it all kind of seems to go to the place that we talked about so much with James Bond torture, where, you know, you have this moment of like doubt and fear and agony for the hero, and it makes him more relatable, and he can come back from it. But to me, it feels like obligatory at this point in Tom Cruise movies, that moment of, I'm not sure I can go on. And then it makes it more exciting when he does.
Well, I would say, but to go to the flip side of that, though, I mean, these films and the effort that he goes through to make them is, of course, a battle against his age of getting old and not being able to do the things that younger stars are more physically capable of doing. I mean, he is.
That Henry Cavill couldn't do because of insurance reasons.
Oh, really?
I think I read something about that.
That's pretty great.
Does he just need to get onto Tom Cruise's insurance? Like,
well, I think it probably had to do with his Superman status. Oh,
yeah, if he broke his lip, that'd have even more stuff to CGI.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, I mean, of course, Tom Cruise broke his ankle making this movie. He was out for like eight or nine weeks. And I think
picture Cavill just on a couch fanning himself, you know,
pulling out, I want to say,
not like, allowed to get off this couch, insurance reasons.
And he's just like, "Have you tried stuntmen, dear boy?"
But this is Tom Cruise's Buster Keaton, right? I mean, this is somebody who is so determined to remain a star, to be, you know, that he is willing to seriously risk injury and risk his life really to entertain us. I mean, that was something that Buster Keaton did all of the time.
Is that why he's doing it?
Yeah. See, that's the thing. It's like, I think like that connotes a bit of desperation or people pleasing to him wanting to do this. I think he wants to do it because he's a thrill seeker and he's like, I'm in a position where I can do these insane stunt things that no one else can do, and I'm gonna, because it's fun.
I think also, though, I think he wants to be the biggest movie star in the world, and the avenue by which he can do that has narrowed to action films, and it's narrowed even a little bit to Mission Impossible action films at this point. Mm-hmm.
And Edge of Tomorrow.
He's giving it.
And Edge of Tomorrow.
Well, in terms of ones that are extremely successful, though. Edge of Tomorrow was not. And the Jack Reacher sequel was not. And The Mummy famously was not. Mm-hmm. And American Made was sort of a smaller scale thing, but also
not a huge success, despite being totally awesome.
Being very good. So, yeah, I was looking at his filmography. It's weird. Do you count Top Gun as an action film?
I would not care.
Really? No.
Like a drama?
Do you count? I mean, it's
it's a drama with some pretty thrilling action sequences.
Do you count Days of Thunder as an action film? I mean, maybe.
I've never seen Days of Thunder.
Yeah, I haven't either, actually. But
cool. Trickle, everybody.
But, I mean, if you, by those, you know, he just. Mission Impossible is basically his first action film, and that's pretty deep into his career. And it's sort of relegated to the Mission Impossible series, you know, more or less, depending on how you cut it, up until, you know, you get into Valkyrie and then Night and Day. And then since Night and Day, you know, you have your occasional strays into other things, but it's almost been all action films since then.
Interesting.
Anyway.
Yeah. As a giant theory of Tom Cruise goes, it is pretty interesting. And it's just fascinating that he has been able to call the shots around those films so thoroughly.
Definitely. And it made some really compelling choices in terms of making a series that's going to be very well crafted and that's going to be self-contained and yet still maintain the audience's interest. You know, I mean, the resistance to mythology and world building is to be such a big plus. I like the idea of just going into a Mission Impossible movie and not having known every single thing that happened.
But did you catch the first movie throwback mythology moment in Fallout?
Maybe. What was it?
White Widow is Max's daughter.
Oh.
Like they're having the
oh no.
The thing honoring her dead mother and she talks about Max.
How do I feel about that?
Well, okay, to keep it on the Tom Cruise subject, sure. Though. So a question I've been thinking about is, has Tom Cruise made this a franchise that can't continue without him? Is there a Mission Impossible without Tom Cruise? Because I feel like they've several times brought in figures that are kind of like teased as like, this is the person that could replace Ethan Hunt. Like there was a Jeremy Renner character and Pie in the Sky, Rebecca Ferguson, you know, but like, I feel like Tom Cruise has made these movies so much about the Tom Cruise-ness of it all that it can't do what the Bond series, for example, has done, you know, but maybe, I don't know.
No, I think it doesn't survive without him because it is something he has taken ownership of in a way that, you know, Sean Connery and George Lazenby and Roger Moore have not. I mean, they've been replaceable parts in a larger franchise, but he is the fulcrum, I guess, of this whole thing, right?
I don't know. I think it's pretty easy to imagine a period where people were saying this Sean Connery seems to be slowly aging out of James Bond. The series is over because nobody else could play it like he does. Like,
nobody does it better.
Nice.
Yeah, my understanding is that the Ghost Protocol and Renner's presence in it was originally supposed to be at least set up the possibility of the passing of the torch. And I believe that script was reworked on the fly, like so many Bradbury projects, to change it a little bit. And Renner gets a little de-emphasized in some ways, a little bit less backstory than we would have gotten otherwise. So, you know, he came back for five. He's absent from this one. But, you know, I don't think that handoff is going to happen at this point. But
I think the siren call of, a dump truck full of money is always going to be mm-hmm. like if there were two or three of them in a row without Tom Cruise and none of them made any money, then I think it might lie fallow for a generation. But I mean, I don't think anybody is really indispensable when it comes to an action movie, particularly an action movie franchise with this appealing and simple of a setup and this long of a history.
Maybe.
Here's my Tom Cruise question. Has he become a better actor, or have people become better at writing for his range? Or
he's good though. I reject your premise. From Risky Business on, I think he's very good.
I think keeping it to the subject of this podcast, he has some pretty clunky moments in the first Mission Impossible of acting, and I think that his best moments of acting in the first film especially, and to an extent in this latest one as well, are nonverbal acting, like those little looks, you know, that you talked about in the bathroom sequence, or the little look on the train that he gives before the hook. Like, I mean, he has a way of, I think, projecting humor or giving a little certain layer to an interaction from a look, you know, and that's like a charisma thing, you know. When it comes to delivering actual specifics about his character's motivation or history, I think it's a lot more dependent on the writing. And I think as the series has evolved and Ethan Hunt has gotten more like complex as a character, and Cruise has had more say in how that character has evolved, I think his performance as Hunt, it's a lot more natural in this latest one than it is in the first Mission Impossible.
I completely agree. Definitely. Well, one other thing, I mean, we've talked about Ethan Hunt, but what about Ethan Hunt's women?
Oh my God.
He's so aromantic, and he always gets like these, well, obviously there's this grand love story of Julia that is not in the first movie. I'd completely forgotten the whole thing about his parents being his mom, I guess. Hey, there's one of Ethan Hunt's women being the motivation in the first one. But like, he's had this grand love story tragedy of Julia since I think the second movie? Third. And like this latest movie, like they decided to like fill that out a little bit and give her some closure, which I think I like how they did that. I'm glad they did it.
It works.
Yeah. And there's like the suggestion of romance with Ilsa Faust, which I don't care for because I just think like, I don't know. I've never, and I'm not the only person who said this, but I've like never really cared for Tom Cruise as a romantic leading man. It has never really worked for me. And as Ethan Hunt, it really doesn't work for me.
I'm trying to think when it has worked.
Jerry Maguire didn't.
Yeah, it works for Jerry Maguire.
Not into Jerry Maguire?
Yeah. I was pretty young when I saw Jerry Maguire.
Good. I rewatched it about a couple months ago. It's really good.
I mean, I think he can be like romantic in the classic sense of the word, but in terms of having like on-screen romantic chemistry,
it's really forced here. Yeah. Here, just to limit it to this. Yeah, it's sort of like there's only two women he's ever really had chemistry with, and it's like,
he took my breath away at Top Gun.
But isn't that kind of a line in Fallout though? It's like there's only two women. Yeah, yeah, the whole sequence is like.
I mean, I think it says something that has to be explained in a monologue. He has emotions, and here is a list of them, because otherwise it wouldn't necessarily come across.
Yeah.
And I mean, Ving Rhames, also charismatic and just has a way, like a calm and almost fatherly way of bringing across information that I think is about as effective as that could have been. But I don't know. I mean, I kind of liked his chemistry with Ilsa in Rogue Nation. And then here, all of a sudden, she's like a child that needs his protection. And the way these movies go back and forth between women are tough, capable, trained agents that can do amazing things, and they're vulnerable, scared children who need his protection. Over and over and over, we see that dynamic, and it squicks me out.
When is she a child that needs his in this? I don't.
Yeah. In Fallout, yeah. There's just the constant, like, you.
I mean,
you
she's so much on the outside of things a lot of the time.
But every time he runs into her, he's like, "I got you out. You were safe. Like, I'm just trying to protect you here. You need to continue to get out." She's like, "I can't. That's not how it works." So then he goes and does all of this stuff to try to get her out again, like he did in the last film. And like in Rogue Nation, she saves his life multiple times, and his reaction is still kind of like, I'm going to rescue you. It's like the two of them seem to be living in entirely different worlds in terms of what she needs. But the film keeps kind of veering forcibly towards the narrative of what she needs is what he thinks she needs. And I just don't buy it.
And I think that the whole, like, there's only been two women thing, like, Fallout, like, really, I think, makes an effort to closely associate Ilsa and Julia in a way that I don't really care for, because it does kind of play into Ethan's whole thing about failing the woman he loves and trying to keep her safe from harm. And Fallout is just so much about Ethan's, like, fear of the worst happening, mm-hmm. you know? And so he's been projecting that onto Julia for several movies now, and I feel like this movie, like, is kind of doing the work to transition that anxiety onto Ilsa, and it does kind of feel at odds with how she was introduced to this series as, you know, someone exceedingly capable in her own right. And she is still exceedingly capable in this movie.
She's Ethan Hunt-like. I mean, yeah. I think her appearances are the strongest when they basically just present her as an equal to Ethan Hunt, yeah. and right down to the unclear motivations and some, you know, misinterpreted loyalties.
And I think it's interesting. I mean, this entire series is about him protecting people he cares about. And if you squint and look sideways and pretend that they were all, like, written with a thoughtful continuity, you can trace that back to his loss of his first team mm-hmm. in the first film.
I actually wrote in my notes, like, this is the formative incident. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the Ethan Hunt tragic origin story.
Sure.
You know?
So when he goes just way, way, way out of his way to save Benji in Rogue Nation, you can still feel, like, he feels that protective urge towards everybody that he's designated as his family. It's just only with women does it also take on this sort of laborious, and we have to make it romantic too, for some reason. And it, like, that aspect, I love the image of him as, like, he lost his father figure in the first film because his father figure was a traitor. He's perpetually dealing with either traitors or people who think he's a traitor. He's constantly trying to protect the people that he cares about. I love all of that. Like, that speaks to me emotionally. And then you turn around and turn it into this sort of combination paternal romantic thing, and it, all of a sudden, it gets weird.
I would be remiss if I did not mention this hilarious article by our friend Matt Desim at Slate. He wrote an article that entitled "Get Ready for Mission Impossible Fallout" with this recap of the entire series from Michelle Monaghan's character's perspective. And it is this great breakdown. And I'll share this about the first Mission Impossible. About director Brian De Palma wasted no time breaking Mission Impossible loose from the TV series it was based on. That starts with the unconventional way he handled the carry of Julia Mead. De Palma keeps her completely off screen throughout the entire film and doesn't even allude to her existence. It's very clever and worth checking out, and kind of an interesting supplement to what we're talking about with that particular character.
Sounds fun.
It's very fun. And what about Mission Impossible? What about Emmanuel Bayar? I mean, there's an element to that character that is very De Palma-y in that when Ethan Hunt suspects that she is in cahoots with the bad guys, there's an element of sexual threat, of sexual violence, etc., which is, you know, very much a De Palma kind of thing. What did you make of that character, the overall scope of that character in the film?
I thought it was super weird and just very Brian De Palma-y that he responds to she might be a traitor by sort of making as though he's going to rape her. Like, it doesn't fit in that character as we later come to know him. It doesn't fit in anything Tom Cruise tends to do. And it just feels really forced to me.
It's just a very thorough search.
which has to take place on a bed for some reason.
I think she plays it very well, though. Oh, sure. I think playing as like someone who actually cares about a much older husband who is capable as an agent herself, but also kind of reads as a helpless femme, but also a femme fatale. And it's all, I mean, she's just very good in a role that's kind of impossible.
And it's like she's got some sort of impossible mission. Yeah.
And like bringing it back to the Bond parallels, I like that this series hasn't really gone with the femme fatale route too much that I can recall. Like, I don't know that the vulnerable at-risk woman is necessarily a better archetype to commit to. But I guess just in terms of like what the Clara character could have been and if the series had kind of decided to commit to something different.
I mean, Claire is 50% of what I'm thinking about when I talk about a woman who, in theory, is trained and capable. I mean, mm-hmm. she's an agent too, but what we see of her is, you know, vulnerable and doe-eyed and needing his protection.
Although we don't really ever understand like what her skills are. Like she's in the getaway car, and that I think might speak more to her relationship with John Voight's character. Like, I mean, there's a whole story there, obviously, you know, but I don't think she's necessarily introduced as hyper capable and powerful the way that Ilse Faust, for example, is.
Yeah, I mean, certainly not to that level.
She's powerful as a femme fatale, not powerful as a physical being who's highly trained or whatever and of a level with Ethan Hunt in terms of whatever skill set she might have.
But then what comes of that? Like the scene where she's sitting in the sleeping bag and she reaches out to him and kisses his hand, and he looks like he's never had his body touched by a woman before in spite of nearly assaulting her earlier. Mm-hmm. And then we just kind of fade to black. Like, are we meant to believe that she seduced him, or that he has feelings for her coming out of whatever that moment is? Because mm-hmm. I feel like the film plays it after that like something happened, and whether that was they had sex or she tried to get him to and couldn't. Like, John Voight definitely plays off a, like, she used her wiles on you and something happened, but it wasn't what I wanted to happen. But I don't know what happened because I don't sense any emotional fallout from it.
There's kind of that teasing aspect to that character. I mean, maybe, and that's, again, the femme fatale thing where you're thinking, well, is she duplicitous? Where do her loyalties lie? I mean, these are things that she gets to kind of sustain and hold throughout the film until the plot sort of reveals itself, which is a role, maybe not a terribly satisfying role, but I kind of think that's her function in the narrative. One important contrast between these two films is how Mission Impossible as a franchise has evolved from De Palma's version, which is sort of a Hitchcockian twist on the spy thriller, and Fallout, which is much more about stunts and physical action. And so in that sense, the two films are quite different. In the subsequent films, from the subsequent sequels after the first Mission Impossible, kind of kept building toward what we see in Fallout. So maybe that's worth talking about.
I wonder if all long-running spy series or long-running action series kind of drift in the direction of James Bond after a while, where you do have to top what's come before, and then, you know, the set pieces become even more distinct and bigger, and becomes less about everything else except for that. I guess we don't have a huge sample pool, but that's sort of my impression of this, is that it gets Bondier as it goes.
Well, I mean, what choice do you have? I mean, if you're making a sequel and you're not telling some big serialized story, then what do you have to do for the sequel to kind of keep put butts in seats? And I think it's really about just amplification. If you're in amplification in this case means, you know, bigger and more exciting set pieces.
Well, and it also extends to the stakes. I mean, I'm not saying that the stakes are not high in Mission Impossible, but they are specific to the world of spies. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's this list that they don't want to get out that would unmask all of their secret agents around the world. Like, that's obviously a high stakes scenario for Ethan Hunt and the IMF, but it's not necessarily a world ending event. And let's see, when did this series officially like transition over to being always like world-ending events that are being averted? Like, the last three have all involved nuclear materials from at least Ghost Protocol on.
I mean, three was...
It's fun that nobody really remembers.
Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Right. I think he had a fairly nefarious sort of 9/11-inspired plot.
Yeah, well, yeah, and terrorism came into play probably pretty close to after 2001, if I had to guess, you know?
Certainly would make sense.
Yeah. In terms of, I guess, the transition from spy movie to stunt-based action spy movie, you know, I think maybe it, along with the constant like escalation of the action or suspense elements, comes the escalation of stakes, and the way that those stories are told have to match the stakes, maybe.
Yeah, and that's the other evolution too. And I even thought about trying to pitch an article about this, but I couldn't quite formulate a good enough pitch. But the first one is definitely a post-Cold War, who's the enemy now, you know, why don't we, spies are like, you know, turning on each other, like these crisscross loyalties. And then I think it evolves post 9/11 to become, I think it's partially because of that. I mean, I think it's a combination of escalating stakes for the franchise and then the way the world has changed. And
escalating stakes for the world.
Escalating stakes for the world. I mean, you know, the first one's kind of, it's from the same moment that produced GoldenEye, where it's the old world order is crumbled. Who's going to be on top, and everyone's trying to grab a piece of it. And that's sort of the sense of, that's the world of those films. And reflecting the world around them, and that's definitely changed. But both have changed over the years. I miss the confusion of the 90s.
I think maybe in the 90s there was a little more of a feeling of like power in the right hands was always a good thing. You know, in this case, it's secrecy in the right hands. Mm-hmm. It's all of these hidden agents staying hidden is a good thing because it benefits the United States. And I think as the series has gone forward, it's been more and more about, you know, who has power and whether that's a good thing. And that just that whole, like, is the IMF like an inherent good, or, you know, is it too much power, just keeps coming up over and over again. And I think that that reflects an ongoing distrust, like worldwide, with leadership and, you know, a concern about who's in charge and what they're doing with it. And like a hope that there are a couple of good men that, you know, are behind the scenes making everything work, but not necessarily a belief that that's true.
IMF is deep state.
Well, so Mission Impossible is available on DVD and Blu-ray and on all the usual streaming sources. If you're a Starz subscriber, it's currently available Letterboxd, which isn't always a guarantee on cable channels. Mission Impossible Fallout is in theaters now and should stick around through the end of the summer. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show, in the hopes that it will put some interesting choices on your radar. Tasha, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
You know what it's going to be. I had a completely different plan for this, but I'm clearly just going to punt and say that people should see The Man from U.N.C.L.E. you know, I'm not the world's biggest Guy Ritchie fan, but I've on and off appreciated some of the stuff that he's done.
Swept Away?
You know, I never saw Swept Away. Okay. I mean, for me, it was really his earliest films, Snatch and Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. There were, I think, moments in the first Sherlock Holmes. I got a laugh out of a lot of sequences in King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is it's the kind of thoroughly redonkulous movie that makes for a great drinking game with friends. But The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was just one of those films I walked into expecting nothing and was just completely taken, I guess, by the chemistry between Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer. Like the way they play out this relationship of two agents from opposing forces who don't like each other and don't want to deal with each other. A lot of what we're seeing exactly in Mission Impossible Fallout, there's just that anti-chemistry of both of them wanting to one-up the other. Both of them want to be James Bond. It's just Armie Hammer wants to be a Russian James Bond. They have very different ways of going about things. They have just sort of very precise ways of dealing with the world, and they clash with each other, but they're forced to work together. It's your classic mismatched buddy movie, except instead of cops, they're, you know, secret super agents. but it's funny. You know, the two of them together are funny, and the film maintains a sense of humor that I don't love everything it does, but a lot of what it does is stylish and fast-paced and fun and based in a kind of chemistry that a lot of action movies just don't have. And in part, that's because so many people are trying to make their action movie heroes the ultimate badass. And here, you can kind of see the ridiculousness of both of them. They're both kind of badasses. And you get to see that in the first sequence where they meet and fight. And it's, you know, it's that bathroom sequence. It's exciting and terrifying and fun. But you see through their rivalry with each other, like, the vulnerability that makes them both interesting. And there's a Bond gets captured and tortured scene with one of them that I just find very stylish and moving and a really interesting way of putting a new spin on the genre. I really like this movie, and it's a little bit hard to explain why, because it is in some ways, you know, yet another franchise starter that failed to start a franchise. But I enjoyed it a lot. I think people should watch it. Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah, I remember giving it somewhat of a mixed review, but it definitely seems to be a film that's found a lot of fans, and something maybe I underestimated a little bit. Keith?
I'm also recommending a movie in which people team up and do things. But,
great transition.
Yeah. We're all about funny connections here on the next show. As a show I watch with my daughter, that would probably watch, even if I did not have a daughter, called Teen Titans Go on the Cartoon Network.
Is there a big bathroom fight in Teen Titans Go?
There's not. There's bathroom humor.
There's a lot of jokes about butts.
A lot of butt and fart
jokes. I got to take my little one to that.
Yeah, no, it's delightful. It's a very clever show that is basically aimed either at kids with a silly streak who like absurd, like superheroes doing things and butt and fart jokes, and then people who are like kind of deeply steeped in DC Comics lore to catch all the in jokes and strange references. And so we sit there together, and then there's one, you know, she's in one camp, I'm in the other, and it's a show that's made for us. I was worried it wasn't, you know, what works at 11 minutes at a time would not necessarily work, you know, at feature length, but it's a delightful film. It's actually finds an actual narrative, sees it through. It actually has a little bit more heart and sincerity than the TV show, which I don't necessarily approve of, but it works here. It should be mentioned that one of the things I love about Teen Titans Go is that, you know, everybody hates Robin, who's their leader, and some episodes end with characters just dead, and there's no continuity, and they're fine by the next episode. It's a clever extension of the show, but it's also a nice riff on superhero movies. A lot of it involves around Robin feeling inadequate because no one's ever made a Robin movie. They go see a movie called Batman Again, which is, and there's fun in jokes like Nicolas Cage turning up as Superman, which he almost was once. And delightful songs.
There's a Kevin Smith.
There's a great sequence involving heroes' origin stories.
Yes, that's the best sequence. It's
excellent. Oh, wow. Yes, I fully support this recommendation. I reviewed it for Vox.com and gave it 4 stars.
Yeah, so. It's out of 4?
Out of 5.
Yeah, that's all right. I like also there's a mix of animation styles. Mm-hmm. They find different things. There's
and a short film at the beginning, a DC Girls one.
By Lauren Faust, yeah. Creator of My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic. Which is quite good too. It seems like she's, not to get too sidetracked, but she's like never seems to get another full-on project. She like does these little short things that never get developed. So hopefully this will be something.
I think it is going to be something.
That'd be good. It was very clever. But yeah, all right. Well, maybe we've gone enough about this. Because did I mention the songs? The songs are
songs are so good.
The songs are really good. The Teen Titans rap is amazing. And,
it's a song by Michael Bolton. Should be nominated for an Oscar.
Yes. So good stuff. If you're not familiar with the show, it's on every hour of the day on Cartoon Network, basically. I think they maybe show some other shows once in a while, but it's always on. And it's at theaters now. How about you, Genevieve?
I'm also going to recommend a movie that is in theaters now, or should still be when you hear this. And that movie is Blindspotting, which is a first-time feature from director Carlos Lopez Estrada, which was written by and stars David Diggs, best known for originating the dual role of Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson in Hamilton, alongside his partner Rafael Casal, a spoken word poet who's made several appearances on Deaf Poetry Jam. This movie premiered at Sundance and released in theaters a week after Sorry to Bother You, a film with which it shares many surface parallels, including its status as a passion project of an Oakland-based rapper. It's a setting in Oakland. It has thematic interests in race and capitalism, and arguably a tendency to stuff too many ideas into a single movie. But despite all of that, Blindspotting is a very different sort of film from Sorry to Bother You, focusing on very different types of characters, specifically a pair of childhood best friends, Colin and Miles, played by Diggs and Casal, respectively. Colin, who is black, and Miles, who is white, work together as movers in their hometown of Oakland, which is rapidly gentrifying, to the vocal chagrin of Miles, who spends much of the movie overcompensating for the fact that he shares a skin tone with those he perceives to be doing the gentrifying. Colin, meanwhile, is just trying to keep his head down and get through the last few days of his probation, which stems from an incident whose nature is revealed over the course of the film. And when Colin witnesses the police shooting of an unarmed black man, the echoes of that incident and how it relates to his friendship with Miles become louder and louder. It all leads to a climactic, reality-breaking moment that will probably not work for some people, and I've already seen it called out as being too much. But it worked for me in large part because of Diggs' performance, which is incredibly arresting in this moment in particular, but also the rest of the film more broadly. There are times when this definitely feels like the work of a bunch of first-time filmmakers who just wanted to put all the ideas and all the stylistic flourish into their first go, but I think it definitely works more than it doesn't, particularly when it keeps its focus on the ground-level story of Colin and Miles' friendship, which is sort of a locus point for all these other ideas. It's a pretty fascinating and very watchable film, which I think, like I said, will still be in theaters by the time you hear this. So, Blindspotting. Check. I don't think any of you have seen it yet. Have you yet?
No, I really want
to. It's on my agenda. There were like four films at Landmark I really wanted to see, and I saw knocked out two of them last week, and I'm going to knock out
that. What did you knock out?
One of them is going to be something I recommend in just a moment, and then the other one was Leave No Trace, which of course which is phenomenal.
That's one of mine. That and Blindspotting.
And then Blindspotting and the Gus Van Sant, I still need to see the.
Yeah.
Don't worry, you won't get far.
Yeah, I'm curious what all of you, but especially what Scott thinks of this big climactic moment.
Please
report back. But you're keeping us in suspense, Scott. What is that last movie you saw that you want to recommend?
Well, so we had talked about potentially pairing Eighth Grade with Welcome to the Dollhouse, another dark portrait of a middle school outcast. But since the window on that idea has closed, I wanted to be the upteenth person to recommend Bo Burnham's directorial debut. But since it's hard for me to talk about the film as authentic to the experiences of an eighth grade girl, though I certainly believed, it certainly seemed quite plausible to me, I did identify strongly with her father, played here by Josh Hamilton. As father to Kayla, an awkward adolescent played wonderfully by Elsie Fisher, Hamilton is playing a type I recognize, the sad, earnest, would-be cool dad who's trying to understand what his daughter's going through but doesn't know how to reach her or make her feel better. The relationship reminded me of what good parenting ultimately is. Not someone who's going to be your best friend for life or who can connect strongly with experiences that you haven't had in decades, but somebody who's simply there, patiently awaiting the moment when their child really does need them and can give them a boost. So it was a very touching aspect in a film that really is very funny and daring and a treat. I mean, I think it sort of earned its reputation. Has everyone seen it at this point?
No, I can't believe I haven't seen it because I've never, this is like the Lady Bird last year in terms of like movies that feel like they were just made especially for me to see. And I'm probably going to go see it this week.
It seems very attuned to what it's like to be in eighth grade now, and of course it made me sad and horrified about I mean, I have daughters who are 7 and 10, so say 3 and 6 years from now I'll be handling this emotion. I mean, for me, eighth grade was by far the hardest grade in terms of my own schooling. I had just moved from a small town in Ohio to a suburb in Atlanta, and I was the new kid, and I was at two different schools that year. And it was a very difficult time, and I think it's just a difficult time for any kid. And the film has a lot of insight into that. So I'm curious, of course, to see what the rest of you think. I'm the only one who's seen it.
No, I
saw it for you.
No, I loved it. I think it's terrific, and I kept worrying about it. I kept worrying it would be, you know, kind of be take a turn for the phony or the contrived,
turn. I'm curious.
You're not in love with some of the things that happen at the end of the movie.
Yeah, but I've heard arguments that are sort of turning me around on it.
I think it's all solid. I think it feels more like an incremental lifting out than a big turnaround. So I love, and I also love this her little play date. great. I love that scene.
Oh, great. Yeah, anyway, so. And we're recommending a bunch of things that people can see in theaters right now.
Yeah, and also, with the exception of Tasha's, all first-time feature filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Bunch of debuts.
Always coming up with connections.
Yep.
So that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next pairing will come out August 21st and 28th. Tasha, what do we have coming up?
Steven Spielberg more or less kicked off the entire idea of the summer blockbuster with his 1975 classic Jaws about a giant shark terrorizing a Maine town during the height of tourist season. His adaptation of Peter Benchley's novel famously minimized how much of the shark audiences saw, a choice that he made for technical reasons rather than artistic ones, though it certainly paid off artistically as well. The new shark movie, The Meg, starring Jason Statham as a deep-sea diver who encounters a prehistoric giant shark, doesn't seem to be making as much of a secret about what its mega shark looks like. But it's also based on a book, so it's got to be just as good as Jaws, right?
All adaptations of books are.
Granted, Spielberg's early summer film set up high expectations for the rest of 1975's summer movie season. John Turteltaub's action movie is flailing up from the depths at the very end of the summer, which is usually considered a bit of a dumping ground for movies. And where Spielberg's classic has a touch of Moby Dick and Mutiny on the Bounty and Old Man on the Sea about its story of a tyrannical, controlling old sailor who's obsessed with bringing down an elusive deep-sea beast, The Meg looks pretty goofy. But comparing the two will give us an opportunity to talk about the highs and lows of cinema, the way the same themes and ideas can enliven films with very different tones and objectives, and the enduring appeal of the shark movie. And who knows? Maybe The Meg will be better than Jaws.
Narrator, it wasn't. In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Mission Impossible, Mission Impossible Fallout, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days, Keith Phipps?
Oh, I'm all over the place. You can find me at the Rolling Stone. You can find me occasionally at Vox and The Verge. I'm at Vulture a lot these days. Hitting the V's pretty hard. Mm-hmm. You can find me on Twitter at KPhipps3000, and I collect my clips at KeithPhipps.com. And Genevieve, how about you?
You can find my work at the Culture Section at Vox.com, which includes a film review, something Yay. I haven't done Aww. Lately, of and Teen a, Titans Go.
And another one.
And probably another one.
Oh, are Maybe. You not going to do the Spy Who Dumped Me?
We'll see.
Okay. To be determined.
Yeah. She may dump that film.
Yeah. TBD. But yes, you can find my work at Vox, and I am on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Tasha, how about you?
You can find me over at TheVerge.com, writing about film and television and being the film and television editor. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. Scott.
You can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. You can find my work at The Rolling Stone, just like Keith. Also, New York Times, Washington Post, Vulture, and other fine outlets. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings blog. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Dan the Snake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. And thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing a recording space in her home base, Genevieve Kosky's apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time. Bump, bump, bump.